advising that we were talking about. Two, he's been through a number of battles with our interest in American history, American political history, including the demise of the Office of Science and Technology under the Nixon administration, but also some days that involved Congress in these discussions. Most recently, he has been the executive director of the American Association of Engineering Societies, and that's a fourth reason that we're pleased to have him with us. That group, as Reed Johnson and others may be able to testify, was by all accounts a moribund society in 1974 when he took over. The chairman of the board commented that he transformed a nearly moribund organization into an effective and essential arm of the engineering community. It moved from New York to Washington, and it began to tackle urgent problems in the science and engineering field. Finally, he's had a background that from time to time brought him down into departments and agencies where some of the real work was being done on these matters. He served first, for instance, in the White House Office of Science and Technology as assistant director. That was before the action by President Nixon abolishing that office. And then he became the co-founder and deputy director of the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment and helped in a major way to develop it into an analytic arm of Congress for early indications of the consequences of technological change. He has left his position within almost a month and is embarking on the writing of a book on science and technology policy making with special emphasis on technology assessment and the interaction of Congress and the White House in this respect. So for all these reasons, we're very pleased that you could join us and continue our discussions, and look forward very much to what you will tell us.
Well, I'm pleased to be here also, and I I understand your sessions are more in the question and answer, give and take, and I prefer that myself. But before I get into that, I'd like to say that I've read through some of the prior forum reports that you had, and I'm fascinated by the personal interrelationships here. I know and have worked with most of the people who have met with you before, Hugh Loth and Bill Carey, Ed David and Guy Stevens, and so on. And I think what is most fascinating about their recollections is not so much the technical analysis of the art and practice of science advising, but their personal experiences. I've shared many of these experiences, for example, with Ed David and Hugh Loth, from whom you've heard already during the Nixon White House years. So I won't repeat that. What I'd like to do is give you a different dimension, perhaps, something that may be of interest to you and what was happening in the departments and agencies of the executive branch during the Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon years, and then, as Ken indicated, the years following the creation and development of the Office of Technology Assessment. My entry, let me just say by way of background, my entry into science policy is unlikely in happenstance as science policy itself. I graduated from the University of Illinois in engineering, and I accepted an offer by Bell Laboratories to go to law school. They wanted to build their patent position. They, of course, were at the forefront of the development of solid-state physics and communications and computer technologies, and they wanted to put together a team that would advance that patent position. So they put me through law school. They were marvelously generous to me. And when I graduated and had passed the New York Bar Exam, of course, this was at the time President Kennedy was elected. And there was a flurry of activity in Washington, of course, the development of the administration, the staffing of the science and technology part of it. And at that time, Jerry Wiesner, who was science advisor to the president, as you know, was staffing the various departments and agencies, and one of his first appointments was the Assistant Secretary for Science and Technology, Herb Holloman, who is deceased now, but he was a tremendous person and a great influence in the Kennedy administration. I was very, very happy to have passed the bar exam and now to begin work for Bell Laboratories in developing this patent position in computer and information technologies. In law school, I had served in a law review, and I had responsibility for science and technology issues. I had written a law review article in that area, and Senator Paul Douglas of Illinois, who happened to be a confidant of Jerry Wiesner, and who Jerry Wiesner had consulted him on a number of questions of staff appointments in the new administration, and he had recommended me to him solely for reason of this law review article, and with an inflated view of me, which led Wiesner to recommend to Holloman that he call me. I received a call from Holloman. I told him that I had just finished law school and that I really felt indebted to Bell Laboratories, a marvelous institution. I was very happy there. It was the premier, at least at that time, research laboratory in the world, and it had a collegial university atmosphere as well. And I just felt indebted. I felt that I had to pay them back for having done all these good things to me. And he said that he would talk to Bill Baker, the president of Bell Laboratories. There should be no trouble in getting me a leave of absence, which he did. And I went down to Washington, which turned out to be longer than 1 year, because at the end of the year, Holloman decided to establish an Office of Invention and Innovation, which would be, in effect, a think tank for the Department of Commerce, for Holloman, and also for the as an auxiliary to the Office of Science and Technology, which Jerry Wiesner led at that time. One of the first things that Holloman assigned to me was to do an assessment of various ways to provide incentives for invention and innovation and to remove barriers to invention and innovation. It was at that time, and we're talking now at the beginning of the Kennedy administration, we were already involved in all of the studies and assessments and recommendations that we have today in international competitiveness and so on. I prepared that report, and it was presented to the Secretary of Commerce and to the President's Science Advisory Committee, the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, and the Tax Analysis Division of the Treasury Department. And everybody praised the report, but nothing was done about it. It just didn't fly. And the outcome of that was Holloman decided that what was necessary was a blue ribbon panel. You can't just have an assessment and a report and present it to people and have people read it. You really have to have a blue ribbon panel, which would engender and elicit the command, the respect and attention of the president, the cabinet, industry, the universities, and so on. So a blue ribbon panel was appointed. It was chaired by Bob Sharpie, who was the president of the Cabot Corporation. It was an outstanding group. Pete Peterson, who at that time was president of Bell and Howell, who later became the Secretary of Commerce, and then the chairman and chief executive officer of Lehman Brothers, and many other outstanding people and government individuals as well, the Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust and the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Tax Analysis and so on. We, of course, at this time, the Johnson administration had come into being, and we labored on this project, enlisting the aid of industry, universities, the government agencies, and came out with a report which I wrote called Technological Innovation, Its Environment and Management. It was a forerunner of all of the innovation studies from that time to the present. And its recommendations cover the whole gamut of tax policy, antitrust policy, patent policy, economic policy, regulatory policy, environmental policy, and so on. The report was presented to the cabinet and to President Johnson personally. And again, they were all very very pleased with it. There were accolades and praise, but very little was done about it. There were some recommendations that were implemented. But the problem was, and the problem of science advising in general, is that all of the efforts to spur invention and innovation and to nurture science are small parts of larger economic policies and are subservient to other interests in the major departments of government. The proposal at that time, which was implemented incidentally for tax credits for research and development, really had to go through the hurdle of all the other tax considerations in the Department of Treasury. The proposals with respect to cooperative research and development had to go through the Justice Department with all of the reasons why this would not be a good idea. The regulatory recommendations likewise had to go through the various regulatory agencies. The outcome of that effort was, as I say, there was some accomplishment. Some of the recommendations were implemented, but by and large, they were filed, and there was not anything done about them. The area of education was also terribly important as far as innovation policy was concerned, and the Department of Commerce, under the leadership of Herb Holloman at that time, initiated a study of engineering and the possible ways in which design and the art of engineering could be brought into the educational system. The complaint at that time was it was too analytical. It was really a reflection of science education, and if engineers were not to become engineers and the ones who would bring forth new technologies and enhance America's competitive stature, then who was to do it? There was a major national conference on this subject attended by government, industry, educators, and out of that came a book called Education for Innovation, which I co-authored and edited. That led to some developments, but again, there was no real change in the educational system. Today, they're still talking about this, and those of you who are involved in engineering education are well aware of the conflicting points of view on this and the tremendous demands on the education of engineers as it is. Nevertheless, the report had some impact, and we still have the issues with us. Another experience that I think would be of interest is the metric study for Congress. This was, at that date, the largest technology assessment ever undertaken by the government. It involved an assessment of all of the implications and consequences of change in industry and society at large, in education and government. It was a three-year study which I took over at the end of the first year. And at the end of that period, we published 14 volumes of reports on all of the consequences of the metric changeover in the United States. And I wrote the summary volume, which was entitled A Metric America, A Decision Whose Time Has Come. The result of that effort was that there was metric legislation passed, the first in American history, and industry has, by and large, converted to metric standards. The educational system is quite comfortable with metric units. The society as a whole has not begun to consider a changeover, and it's not likely to happen for a long time to come. Nevertheless, there was some accomplishment in that, and particularly in view of the importance to industry of internationalizing its activities, this, I think, was a beneficial result. But like every other effort in the science and technology policy realm, one has to be satisfied with a little step at a time. After that effort, Ed David asked me, this was in late 1970, Ed David had just come on board in the Nixon White House as science advisor, and he asked me to join his staff, which I did. And you've heard from Ed David, and you've heard from Hugh Loweth about those years. They were very trying ones, ultimately leading to the demise of the Office of Science and Technology. I have just one comment I'd like to make in general before we get into our discussion, and that is the most important aspect of any science advisor or science advisor staff's activity in the White House or in the executive branch realm is not the genius and brilliance and capabilities of these individuals, the science advisor or the staff, but the personal interrelationships with the true power centers in the White House apparatus, which is not the science policy activity in any administration. Indeed, the ability to elicit personal trust and indeed endearment on the part of these very important people in the Office of Management and Budget, the National Security Council, the Council of Economic Advisors really makes the difference. And to paraphrase Vince Lombardi, this personal attribute, this ability to elicit trust and endearment is not everything. It's the only thing in that environment. The various experiences there, which again you've heard, the New Technology Opportunities Program, the various presidential messages. I might mention something about presidential messages. I had, of course, I just finished the metric study for Congress. I had spent 2 years of my life on it, and I thought that the president should back this. The first presidential message on science and technology ever sent to the Congress was to be issued in 1972. And it was because of my personal relationship with Hugh Loweth, who really controlled these matters. He was in the Office of Management and Budget, as you know, but he really controlled what went into the president's science and technology message. He and I, at the end of the day, used to go across the street to a little bar across from the executive office building and sip scotch and talk about things. And I talked to him about the metric system one night, and it got into the president's science and technology message. This is by and large how things happen there. It isn't because of the logic of anything or necessarily the brilliance of any idea. It is the personal interaction and the team camaraderie and the trust and respect that is developed through these personal interactions that really gets the job done. Well, after the Office of Science and Technology was abolished, I was asked to be the Deputy Director of the Office of Technology Assessment, which had a statutory basis, but it did not exist. Let me step back a moment. In the period before the enactment of this legislation, the Office of Management and Budget and the White House staffs were very concerned about this proposition because the key proponent of this Office of Technology Assessment was Senator Ted Kennedy. He, of course, was anathema to the Nixon White House and to many others as well. And many people felt that the Office of Technology Assessment would become an agency of Kennedy's and not of the Congress. And they also felt that the agency would become, because of his perceived anti-technology bent, it would become an Office of Technology Harassment rather than an Office of Technology Assessment. Hugh Loweth and I were asked to look at this, so it's very interesting that I was involved in looking at this for the White House before it actually was created. And my opinion, which I gave freely, was that if the legislation were implemented in the manner in which it was specified, it would be good for everyone. It would be good for the White House, it would be good for the Congress, it would be good for the country. is it is a marvelous specification for technology analysis. Moreover, the structure of the office called for a bipartisan board, which would be half Republican and half Democrat, and of all shades of political opinion and ideology, so that there was a safeguard built into the legislation that would prevent it from becoming an agency of Senator Ted Kennedy. Anyway, this view was never really bought in the White House, and there was continual opposition to the creation of the office by the Republican allies of the Nixon White House, particularly in the House. Ultimately, the legislation passed. There was a very small appropriation made for it, and the office was opened in December of 1973. We occupied three rooms in the Congressional Hotel at that time. We started from scratch, and it was a very precarious beginning. I just want to briefly go through three phases of the development of OTA. I understand that Jack Gibbons, who is now the director of OTA, will be visiting with you, and you can hear from him about some of the things that have been achieved during his tenure as director, which has been, I think, the culmination of a very stormy early period, and OTA is in good hands at this time. But at the beginning, nobody expected it to survive past the first year. And the reason was that the members of the OTA Congressional Board, senators and congressmen, even though it was bipartisan, came to this activity with the mentality that they had always practiced in the committees. They regarded the Office of Technology Assessment as another committee, so that each senator and each congressman would be entitled to a staff member, would be entitled to patronage, would be entitled to special studies on his or her behalf. And of course, this would never work for the Office of Technology Assessment. It was a very, very challenging initial period, and the director at that time was probably the only one who could pull it off. He was the author, he was former Congressman Emilio Daddario, who during his years in the House really led the way toward the systematic assessment of scientific issues, and was the author of the OTA legislation. He was the logical first choice to be director. He was the political director. I was the, you might say, the executive vice president. I was the operational director of OTA. But without his political skills and insights, OTA would not have survived. He had to balance all of these political intrusions and demands with the long-term interests of OTA, so that initially, there were political influences in the office. There had to be. There was no way to avoid it. Each senator was entitled to a staff member in OTA. And of course, that staff member was not really responsible to me as the operational director. He was responsible in Kennedy's case to Kennedy, in Hollings' case to Hollings, in Senator Case, who was then the ranking minority senator, to him, and so on the House side. So there were 12 staff members in a very small staff who had owed their allegiance and loyalty not to the institution but to their respective senators and congressmen. Needless to say, this is a very difficult organization to get off the ground, but it did work because Kennedy was able to minimize the political side railing of what we had to do. He was able to minimize the intrusions of the senators and congressmen. He was able to persuade them eventually that it was in their interests, as well as the interests of the institution, that these staff members be fully operative and working members of OTA, and that the demands on them placed by the senators and congressmen be kept at a minimum. Eventually, of course, this, I think it was, let's see, we're talking about 1977, Mr. D'Addario had never intended to stay his full term. We were appointed for 6-year terms, he and I. And at the end of approximately 3.5 years, he announced his intention to resign. The next director of OTA was the former governor of Delaware, Russell Peterson. I don't know how acquainted you are with him, but he's a very dynamic individual with very set opinions. He came to OTA with great credentials, but also great biases, which I shared his biases, but it's very difficult to run an office of technology assessment if you are biased one way or the other. He was an avowed environmentalist and would not brook any opposition from any quarter, including senators and congressmen. He more or less wanted to go his own way, and of course he did not last very long, needless to say. He lasted 1 year. During that year, though, a great deal was accomplished for OTA, and it set the stage now for phase three. What was accomplished was, he refused to accept the position of director, to his great credit, unless the political patronage system was eliminated, so that the senators and congressmen who previously had staff members now no longer had staff members in OTA. That was a tremendous achievement. He accomplished other things as well. He initiated a priorities review, which was to establish the priority issues that OTA should address, not just what members of the board of OTA wanted assessed or what chairman of committees wanted assessed, but what were truly the most important issues facing the nation and the world over the next decade, the remainder of the century. And for that, he also earned the enmity of many individuals, including, unfortunately, the Advisory Council, OTA. I should explain that the Office of Technology Assessment consists of the staff and the director. The Technology Assessment Board, which is a congressional board of directors. And then a Technology Assessment Advisory Council, which consists of individuals from the private sector, universities, and so on, distinguished scientists and people from other fields who can contribute to the assessment process. It also includes the head of the General Accounting Office in government and the director of the Congressional Research Service. Russell Peterson, in his enthusiasm, did not consult with anybody, including the Technology Assessment Advisory Council, which at that time was chaired by Jerry Wiesner, who took great offense at the notion that there should be a list of 100 priority issues in which he had no opportunity to contribute. And that also, and he, of course, was, at that time, as always, a very close ally of Senator Kennedy, who was chairman of the board of OTA at that time. The upshot of all of this was Russ Peterson was, in effect, let go at the end of his year. But the office had been transformed, never to be the same again. And at that time, Jack Gibbons came in as director of OTA. He was the ideal choice for the position because he was thoroughly objective. He was a distinguished scientist. He was well-liked. He had experience in the executive branch and in the private sector, and he's done a hell of a job since then. You'll be hearing from him when he comes to visit with you. I think maybe I ought to stop here so we can have some exchange.
It seems to me a starter might be this. Would it be useful on a long run basis to, in effect, merge the operation of the science advisor and the OTA? Rather than have two different entities?
I think this is something that in various forums that has been thought about. It's never been acted on. It's a very important option, I think. Now, that the personal function of the science advisor to the president obviously would have to remain in the White House. But the current setup where there's an Office of Science and Technology Policy, which is supposed to do assessments of policy issues that are very similar to the ones done by the Office of Technology Assessment in Congress, could very well be done by an independent think tank that provided these assessments for both the executive branch and the congressional branch. And now that the political ingredients of OTA have been minimized, they're never eliminated. They're not eliminated in OTA any more than they are in OSTP. But now that they have been minimized, I think that that is a feasible option. It would be it would have to be carefully structured so that the institution could perform objective assessments. It would have to be disciplined in a way that it did not become an advocate for one point of view or another, which is the OTA mold, incidentally, and not the OSTP mold. I think it's a realistic option, and I think it's one worthy of consideration by the White House and the Congress. Whether or not they would give up their current institutions, which is always a problem. Once an institution is established and there's a congressional committee which has oversight, which is true in the case of OSTP, and also, of course, in the case of OTA, it's very difficult to change that.
Next question.
Yes. I'm still a little unclear about the Office of Technology Assessment. Where is most of the assessment going on? Is it within the political the board of congressmen, or is it the director, or does the advisory council play a role? I'm not clear as to that.
The process by which these issues are assessed, let me just kind of briefly run through it. First of all, the request for assessments can come from three quarters. One from the chairman of a congressional committee, or the ranking minority member, or a majority of the members can request an assessment of whatever it may be, nuclear war, energy, environment. The Technology Assessment Board, the congressional board, can also request it. And thirdly, the director can initiate it if he has the approval of the board. The assessments are undertaken by in-house staff in OTA with the aid of outside consultants and contractors as needed. The OTA staff is not sufficient to cover the whole gamut of technology and science-related issues. The Technology Advisory Council, this group that I mentioned earlier, is sort of a sounding board for all assessments, but they do not themselves possess the adequate breadth and scope and depth for these assessments in specific cases. So that in each case, an advisory panel is appointed, which consists of representatives of all points of view, people that have an interest in it, stakes in it, who will be affected by it, and almost always people with opposing points of view. They do not determine the results of the assessment, but they are a very important ingredient to it. They more or less keep it honest. And then ultimately, when the assessment is complete, first, the congressional board approves the assessment, but they do not approve the result. And when the result is issued, it's published and made available to the public and congressional committees.
Want to follow up on that?
Are staff members specialists in certain areas? And so if an assessment is requested in a certain field, that staff member says, okay, you're a specialist in this area, you take it.
Yes, they're specialists, but by and large, they're generalists. There are three major areas in the Office of Technology Assessment, and the assistant directors, they're headed by assistant directors, are generalists. They have to be. They can't really be expert in, for example, nuclear technology and solar technology and communications technology, the whole gamut of things. But there are specialists on the staff as well.
Would Chris Wright be an example of a generalist?
Yes, Chris Wright was a generalist.
Son of Quincy Wright, who after retirement from Chicago came here and taught for a number of years in the Department of Government, very distinguished international lawyer. You both worked with him, didn't you?
Yes, Chris Wright was an outstanding member of the staff of OTA, and he was a generalist. He headed the research and development analyses during the late 1970s.
Could you give us some idea of the dimensions? How big a staff did OTA have? How many projects more?
The size of the staff varies, but at the present time, I believe it's around 150, give or take. That figure is kind of ambiguous because there are many resident consultants and resident contractors, and also detailed people from other agencies. But I'd say roughly 150. That is complemented by a rather large force of consultants and contractors on the inside. Then your second question was the budget?
Well, I was thinking, I'd like the budget to the number of projects.
The number of projects that are going on at any one time are, I'm just guessing now because I left some time ago. I would say about 20 to 30 at any one time. Each project, the major assessments take about 1.5 to 2 years to complete. And during the course of the assessment, there are byproducts that, for example, interim reports can be provided to committees and other interested parties.
Are the reports widely published?
Yes, they are.
By GPO,
and of course they're reported fairly frequently in the newspapers. You probably read recently about the most recent OTA report was on the likelihood of another shuttle disaster. You may have read about that in the Washington Post and New York Times.
50%?
Yeah.
Victor Yankee.
Dr. Damone, how do you sort out the priorities between different groups and pressure groups? Is that an immense task?
You mean in the Office of Technology
Yeah.
Assessment? It's a balancing act, and of course, the problem before the creation of OTA is that only certain voices were heard, namely mostly voices of industrial interests and other special interest groups. And the Congress was faced with the same dilemmas that the White House was faced, for example, on the question of the SST and the anti-ballistic missile and the effects of nuclear war. All of the weight of the testimony was on the side of the special interests. What OTA has done is brought in all of the people who have a stake in it. And this is very carefully watched. And how do you balance it? I guess it's a question of good judgment. To ensure that, for example, if there's an assessment of the effects of nuclear war, not just the Department of Defense is heard on this issue, that all of the others who can contribute or who would be affected by it are also heard. That's how it's done, really.
What do you think the level or the amount of bribery and corruption and this sort of thing is in trying to influence the people in this area? Or do you think it's just a question of whose personality is the most charming for going up?
You mean, for example, in the White House?
Yes.
Well, I don't want to give the impression that there's anything venal or evil about the process. There are a lot of well-meaning individuals in the White House environment who want to see things done that they think are in the national interest, and they will use whatever means they have available to further that aim. I'm not aware of any instance where there was anything such as bribery involved or, you know, special favors to, for example, somebody on the OMB staff, which is really the key, the switching center. Now, on the congressional scene, of course, there were times when industry representatives would come in and they would present these elaborate presentations on why the restrictions on emissions and the Environmental Act should be lifted and all of this, and they would exercise every initiative to do that. But I don't know of a single case of bribery. No. Maybe some have. I'm just not aware of it.
I An engineer and then a biologist, Reed Johnson.
An engineering educator, I hope. You mentioned early in your remarks the difficulties that engineering educators face with divergent requirements, one of which is, and it's been largely satisfied recently, that the engineer have a major component of humanities or liberal arts in his program. On the other hand, we are continually faced, we in the technological community, with the demand to try to educate non-technical people in various aspects of technology, from anywhere from congressman on down to your neighbor and your friend. And there's very little done in the liberal arts education area to perform this task. Do you have any suggestions as to how, if we go further and further into the era of technology, something can be done to bring the base level of knowledge of the, quote, general public up in the area of technological understanding?
This is very, very important, I think, and one of the elements of national science policy that is largely left to chance is the pre-college science and technology education. All of the talk about competitiveness and how we fit in the world, and it's not going to go away. We're not lost. We have as much opportunity as any other nation to shine in this. We'll depend upon human capital. It's, it really doesn't depend upon material resources anymore. Japan's a good example of that. So it's very important that young people be educated as much as possible. Not everybody's going to be a scientist or an engineer. Just thank heavens, many people will say that. But they should. I think everyone should have a level of understanding and appreciation for the increasingly scientific and technological content of our everyday lives. How that's going to be done, I don't know. This requires, obviously, more than just exhortation. It requires funding. It requires support. We've got Graham Rudman Hollings. We've got an administration that is not interested in any further taxation for whatever means, even something like the education of Americans for the future of America. It seems to be an intractable issue, but not one that can't be addressed as long as we have to. But it really requires the will and determination of the Congress and the administration to do something about it. That's one level of it. Of course, the other level of it is what President Bush has called 1,000 points of light. There are other ways, there are additional ways of educating. And so everybody has a responsibility. Every institution has a responsibility to do this. On the college level, I've always felt that one of the best ways to do this would be to establish, say at the university level, here at UVA, a program of technology assessment which would be kind of parallel to what is going on in government. This is not a horrendous proposition. It's not something that is impossible to achieve. The kinds of assessments and analysis that go on in OTA are very conducive to a university atmosphere. And I think that university students, if they were exposed to the process of technology assessment, and say in one course, this would give them an opportunity to look not only at the scientific and technical aspects of energy and war, nuclear war, and communications, and so on, but also the social and economic consequences of various courses of action. It would help them to make judgments on national policy issues that are very difficult to make if one does not take into account all these factors. So, anyway, I think the future, our competitiveness, our well-being now and in the future is going to depend upon intelligent, knowledgeable people who are now in the elementary schools who are in the high schools, who are in college, and so on. And everything has to be done all along that pipeline to ensure that we remain a vital and strong society.
May I make just a follow-up comment? I have recently been involved in a high school teacher's course in which we present nuclear energy in a week-long program. And these are science teachers, physics teachers in both high school and middle school. And after several years of being involved in this program, I will express my sorrow at the very low level of understanding of technology that these people have. And in many cases, they represent the only exposure that high school students have to technology, and therefore the fact that they don't understand it or that they don't follow on into engineering programs or even science programs is not understandable.
Another aspect of this is I think that all Americans and all people everywhere, not just the United States, are concerned about global trends, the environment, and so on. It's very clear in the last presidential campaign. What was one of the number one issue? It's right up there. Technology has been a large part of this problem, but technology is a large part of the solution. Not only here in the United States, but also in the whole global aspect of it. The International Geosphere Biosphere Program, for example, which is now underway, will depend very, very importantly on what is done by engineers, not just scientists, but by engineers in trying to solve the problems caused by technology. And I think if people realize that technology could be a tool for this aim, which they all share, instead of the problem, that it would help them to feel better about the possibilities and also want to know more about the technology.
Do we? Go to Bob right away, but do we undervalue technology? Professor Billy. Merit in that view, or the scientists sometimes don't think there is?
Well, the question of the title has always been there and always will be. They want to change the name of the National Science Foundation to the National Science and Engineering Foundation, but I think it's understood by most people that engineering is a very important part of it. And when we talk about science policy, for example, we're talking about science and technology policy. The difficulty, I suppose, from the engineering side is that engineers have never been as well organized as scientists. They have never, they're by nature, I guess, I don't want to say antisocial, but they're not the political, they're not as good in politics as scientists are. And they do not cohere very well. It is not very common for engineers to unite for a common purpose. One in which they do unite is to change the name of the National Science Foundation.
Bob Kretzing.
Based off of brief comments, hopefully in balance, and two brief questions. You know, one thing about science and the application of science, that's often equated with technology or engineering, but in an economic sense and a global impact, I'd certainly urge you all be aware of the application of biological sciences. That means agriculture, environment, medicine. This is all applied technology as well. So I wouldn't equate engineering with the application of science. That's a half the total picture.
Sure.
To the question I wanted to ask, does the OTA have access to the Academy, or is it obligatory that reports be reviewed by the Academy to get access to the resources of the Academy?
Yes, OTA does have access to the Academy. It's not obligatory to...
The reports don't have to pass.
Do not pass it. The Academy is an independent government chartered organization. Now, initially, when we opened the OTA, Mim Nadario and I went down and visited with the president of the Academy and the President, the Academy of Sciences and the President of the Academy of Engineering. We talked about possible cooperative activities. We wanted to involve as large a universe of scientists and engineers as possible in our activities. That didn't work out too well. And one of the reasons is the difference in the time constants for the two organizations. The Academy kind of lumbers on forever and ever. It takes them 12 years to do an assessment of the Alaskan wilderness. Congressional committees cannot wait that long. And the general difficulty of getting a consensus opinion from the Academy, number one. Number two, the Academy does take advocacy positions on issues, which is a good thing. I'm not criticizing that. The Office of Technology Assessment is chartered to be objective. It presents options to the Congress on different courses of action. And it's for Congress then to make a decision on any particular issue. The fact of the matter is, though, that when OTA presents options for any particular issue, congressmen and senators pick the one that supports their point of view, and that's usually the way it works. So they can say yes or no on any given OTA assessment.
May I follow up on a previous question about the overlap and possible combination of the OTA and the OSTP? It would seem to me that they, in a sense, serve different constituencies, and perhaps at time would legitimately have somewhat different points of view. I wonder if you might explore a little more how functional, how desirable it would be to keep the two separate, have the two combined.
Well, if they were combined, they would have to be combined in the sense that I mentioned just a moment ago. In order to serve both constituencies, it could not be an advocacy organization. If they were to do an assessment of telecommunications technologies, for example, they would have to present various options to both the White House and the Congress, the same set of options to both the White House and the Congress. And that would be for the President's staff and for the congressional committees and the congressional staff to use those assessments in the manner best suited for their purposes. What it would do, I suppose, would help Graham Rudman and Hollings in reducing the cost of assessments for government. And also, it would also, I think, probably get both organizations above a critical mass where they could really do some assessments that they cannot do now independently of each other.
So in summary, you might say the benefits without really the disadvantages?
Well, the disadvantages would, from whose standpoint? I think the disadvantage from the standpoint of, say, Congressional Technology Assessment Board would be that this would not be their creature. They would not be the ones to approve what assessments were undertaken by this combined institution, which is now the case in OTA. Likewise for OSTP. The current director, who is now the science advisor, would not have that control that he now has. That's a disadvantage. Obviously, any alternative here will have advantages and disadvantages.
Professor Farnbaugh?
I was very interested in your early remarks about the limits of material that you put out that gets into action, how much goes into file drawers. And the frustration that that must produce at times. I can understand that if you come out with an assessment which agrees with the point of view which a particular agency or congressional committee majority is trying to support, it will be readily adopted and approved and get into some kind of action maybe. I can also guess that there is a certain amount of I involved in institutional inertia throughout the system and the tendency to emphasize the short range. I was wondering if anyone has actually done a study of the output of agencies making such assessments to see what kinds of issues are likely to be taken up and put into action and some progress made, what kinds end up in the file drawers?
That would be a very good study. I don't think it has been done explicitly in that fashion. There have been a number of studies of the process of science and technology policy making in the executive branch and various agencies. The causes of inertia, the psychological factors involved, a comprehensive assessment of that, I don't think that's ever been undertaken. I think it would be a fascinating study.
I have two concluding questions, maybe. One, what do you think of these various state and regional efforts, like the Center for Innovative Technology, for instance, in this state, that Linwood Holton chairs. And at this university, there is a body that has been created to work on the adaptation of technological scientific findings, you must know more about it, to the needs of industry. Is this a good thing? And then the second question was, will you tell us a little bit about your book and your plans?
Well, the Center for Innovative Technology is an institution that prima facie is desirable. It's a very difficult proposition, though, to implement because what it sets out to do is, I think, extremely desirable. It sets out to develop stronger ties among the institutions of the state, the industries, the universities, and government agencies. That's very desirable. Picking winners and losers, developing technologies to the point of product, the tie-in with industry, the proprietary rights involved. It's a very complex web of things. I don't mean to say it can't be done, and it can serve a useful purpose, but I think most people who have been involved in the development of these kinds of centers have hopes and expectations that go beyond, I think, what is realistic.
In your book?
Well, I haven't started writing it yet. I do want to try to analyze issues such as the one that you raised on the policymaking process in the executive branch and the Congress, and the possibilities that go beyond that to the possibilities for improved policymaking and interaction and results. But I haven't begun yet. I'm looking forward to it, I must say.
We've got one final question. Dr. Fisher.
How much of our trade deficit do you feel is due to the failure of American industry to join the metric world?
Well, that's unquantifiable, but one thing I can say is that American industry has joined the metric world. American industry, following the metric study, as I indicated, has completely and almost all, in any important case, all international companies are now using metric standards. That's the important thing. And so they have gone metric. They have done this. The only segment of the society that hasn't gone metric is the public. You and I still listen to temperatures and Fahrenheit, and we buy potatoes by the pound and so on. And I think that'll go on for a long time, because the reason that persists is that there really isn't any reason that it should change in the minds of the public. For companies, though, for industry, to get to your question, they really saw a need to change. It was very important for them to do that. Ford Motor Company cannot have plants and operations all around the world, have inch-pound standards here in the United States and metric standards in Europe and Asia. So it was very essential for them to do that, and they have done it.
Well, do you have a final
question? No. Clap.
Well, before Professor Moser claps, we'll all be looking forward to your book.
Well, don't stop him.
Thank you.
Thank you, it's been a great pleasure being with you.